It's time for the Dynamics Podcast. My name is Felix Sattler, and joining us today is Scott A. Marley and Brandon Ahmed. They're going to talk about their experience with local business data, or on-premise, if you want to call it that. It's been a long time coming, and we're really happy to kind of get into the nitty-gritty with this. Small disclaimer, though, I kind of messed up my audio at the beginning of this podcast. So if you don't hear me that much talking in the beginning, it's because my audio was really, really bad. Thank you so much to the person in our chat room who was streaming this live. So somebody in the chat room actually pointed this out to me so I could reduce it. So maybe I'm more at the end of the show. But thank you so much for the guys who watched us live, who made us aware of this. We're going to jump straight into it and talk to the guys. So first up, it's going to be Scott introducing himself, then Brandon, and then we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of things. So stay tuned and enjoy.
This is the Dynamics Podcast, episode 21, recorded October 17, 2017. On-premise experience with Brandon Ahmed and Scott Morley.
So my name's Scott Morley. I'm a principal application architect for OneNeck. It's a hosting provider. So we do managed services and hosting and all of that of AX. I've been using AX for about 8 years now. Started in 2009 and worked my way up. I've been in the IT industry longer than I care to admit. One gray hair for each day that I've been in it. And it's mostly been with ERP systems, supply chain, manufacturing, those kind of things. So that's where I'm from.
Name's Brandon Ahmed. I live in Texas, from Oklahoma, small town. I've been on about 40 implementations, actually over 40 at this stage. Been doing this for quite a few years, have done instructing, and I've also served as a technical architect, sometimes doing some functional work too, and have just been basically traveling around and going everywhere, guys.
Yeah, I wanted to bring you guys on because I know there's a series of presentations coming as webinars on AXUG, and I think there's three of them coming fairly soon, within weeks. I think the first one is actually tomorrow. And I wanted to bring you guys on to talk about what you're going to present. And I know on-prem AX, local business data, as you also can call it, a lot of people are interested to know what's going on there, what's on the scene there. So you're the one that you're doing the presentation tomorrow, Scott, is that right? Or was it?
No, mine's on November 2nd. I'm the last one.
Okay.
Yeah, mine's tomorrow.
Yours tomorrow. So let's have Brandon do his take on the presentation first, then.
Well, you know, I've been implementing on-prem on a major implementation, so I've gotten a lot of work in there, and there's been a lot of lessons learned. Like we were talking about before, being an independent, the excitement for on-prem is pretty strong. A lot of, especially existing customers and bigger implementations that have their own data centers, still prefer an on-prem approach. Mm-hmm. And I think that the biggest thing I'm going to do is speak with them about, you know, what to expect, what not to expect. Here are the lessons learned from having gotten in the field and done it the real way, you know, mm-hmm. beyond all the little fluffy stuff. And I believe it's going to be helpful. You know, a lot of things you can do, like access SQL, you know, be able to see logs, be able to get a client out of trouble. That's wonderful. Performance tuning, I think, for me personally, is a lot easier on-prem than it is in the cloud. So we're going to be discussing things like that. But then, you know, there's some disadvantages too, like this current platform update strategy, for example. Just recently in on-prem, we had a service fabric update that broke the new install. You know, wow. and now with Microsoft, the delay time is much more than it was previously, you know, in the cloud version. And they've made it clear that the cloud is their priority. So there definitely are some things to think about. And people have talked about some of the BI services, things like that coming through. On-prem's got an advantage. You can pretty much use any extension BI that can connect to SQL Server. A lot of people love that, especially people who've got existing solutions. But then there's also the disadvantage of some of Microsoft's out-of-the-box BI, you know, is not quite functioning with on-prem. So really a lot there to be able to get there. And then of course the other thing too, to do the install, and I can say this having gone through it. all right, first of all, guys, you have to be a domain admin or be delegated the permissions of a domain admin. Try that in a billion-dollar organization with an infrastructure department and walk in and tell them that you need domain admin permissions. Okay, or you have to sit with the domain admin and walk them through the actual install, right? Once again, try that with a busy domain admin in a billion-dollar infrastructure department and tell them you need to sit with them while they sit for hours doing many manual steps and you walking them through. So there have been some lessons learned, you know, there really have. Would I recommend it right now? Would I not? I think, you know, right now I'm still 50-50. I think Microsoft will need to make more of a commitment to it at this stage, honestly, before I would fully push it as much as I like it. I do see it though as a more viable solution. And let's face it, I mean, as much as we're seeing a lot of D365 implementations, you know, as an independent, one thing I get to do is I also get to see a lot of implementations that are distressed, that have gotten past a certain point. And, you know, many of the reasons, whenever we do see D365s in trouble, it tends to be cases like the binary update strategy with all those platform updates, you know, not being able to test, not being able to upgrade, not being able to see what's going on, having to call Premier support whenever there's an issue that used to take 5 minutes to solve. And I think that's, I think those are strong points for on-prem for organizations like that. Not saying that D365 doesn't have its own advantages, because there's several organizations that are just loving it. But when there are issues, you know, they tend to revolve heavily around the cloud, around the cloud practices versus, you know, internal practices that may be needed. That's what I'm finding.
Yeah. No, it's always good to hear from people who are actually out there in the fields implementing it and listening to what their experience is. So yeah, that's very interesting. And you, Scott, you said you had one in November. That's right. Your presentation is in November.
Yeah, so my presentation is kind of after, you know, Brandon's done and got everything working and done all the hard work, then I'm there to tell people how not to break it afterwards. So it's really about the care and feeding once it's in place, you know, how to do those platform updates and make sure that if something goes wrong, you can recover from it. So that's the kind of thing that I'm looking at, is once it's in place, you know, how do you do backups? Where's the best place to do backups? What does business continuity look like? Those kind of things.
Mm.
So
Yeah, your company does hosting, you said?
Yeah, so we have our own data centers, and so we do co-location hosting. We have private public cloud as well. And so from our perspective, you know, a lot of our customers are already in that on-premise, not, you know, from them, it's kind of an on-premise install, but it's already in a cloud because it's in our data center. And so for them moving to Azure, you know, they're saying, well, we're already in a cloud. Why would we want to move to a different one? And so a lot of our customers are still kind of looking at that. You know, you guys are already managing it for us. We want you to continue. And so that's really where we're coming at it from, is that upgrade continuity, you know, of the service that we're already providing them.
Mm. Yeah, I've it's been said there is no such thing as a cloud. It's just someone else's computer.
Right.
Yeah. So, but you have also hands-on experience with installing it then by now.
Yeah. So we don't have any customers that have actually moved that yet. They're still kind of hesitant. You know, as Brandon said, there's been a lot of, well, now it's ready. Well, now it's ready. No, now it's ready. So, you know, a lot of the customers are kind of waiting until that final, okay, you know, now we've got X number of installs in place and we know that we can do it. So we have a lot of conversations with customers. We've done some demos for them. So we've gone through a couple of just installs in our own data center, but we don't have anybody that we're actually implementing for. So it's really just, you know, demo type sandbox environments that we've set up.
Yeah.
But it's been a long journey, hasn't it? From where they started, when they introduced AX7 and the promise of being able to be having a fully on-prem solution already when they launched it, and then removed it, and then only Edge, and then we're getting an on-prem, and so I think that they're kind of working that to the final goal at the moment.
Yeah,
they are. Yeah, and there was a big shift in how they were doing it. I mean, originally it was Azure Stack was going to be required, which was a lot more complex than the Service Fabric to get up and running, you know. So I think the delay kind of helped them maybe streamline that and make it so that it's going to be more accessible. Because I think a lot of companies setting up the service fabric, you know, that's more in the realm of a traditional IT department where they could go in and set that up relatively painlessly. Whereas Azure Stack requiring hyper-converged environment and all of that, there's a huge investment that would have been needed for that. So I think in the long, you know, in the long run, it turned out better. Hmm. But it's definitely been a roller coaster.
Yeah. A lot of pushback too from customers on the sheer number of servers.
Right.
That are required. That's probably the biggest. That and the requirement that the domain controller actually be 2016, mm-hmm. as well as ADFS, you know, also be 2016. A lot of existing infrastructure departments that are hosting on site are having a lot of issues with that because, you know, of course, there's plenty of other applications that are on, you know, that are using the same ADFS and breaking 200 other applications to be able to get on-prem in. That's yeah. something that I've definitely run into.
Yeah, so I saw you had to have your domain functional level to Windows 2012 R2. Is that right?
Well, Microsoft came back to us, so I'm gonna tell you what happened with us on there too, because that's how I understood it also. We got an actual response back from the research team that the on-prem actually revolves around having Open Connect ID and OAuth, I think it's 4.0, which were primarily supported in 2016 by default. There's a way to be able to configure it for 2012. The install scripts, though, explicitly block you from being able to install it on 2012 R2.
Oh.
So, yeah, that's kind of the challenge we ran into that was pretty significant that really prevented us from being able to take it live at the moment. I mean, it was enough of a challenge to where, you know, you got 200 other applications using 2012 R2. Taking the domain controller plus the ADFS up to 2016 was deemed to be too disruptive. And so that's been one of the issues we're having.
Yeah. Well, it felt like for me, I don't know if it's true or not, but it felt like to me that so the market somehow or pushed Microsoft quicker into the local business data. And they really wanted to, I don't know, it felt like they were kind of stalling that. But it got to a point where the market demanded on-prem, some answer on the on-prem story.
Yep.
I haven't seen any of our customers demanding on-prem. There have been a few cases where we're in a sales position where the customer potentially wants on-prem only. But a lot of the customers we have, they are happy with doing this in the cloud. I don't know what your experience is on that matter.
Well, what we've seen is so we do managed services for customers in their own data center as well as not just our hosting. And so there's kind of that split, right? Customers that have already invested heavily in their own infrastructure, they don't just want to throw it away. You know, so they're saying we just spent, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on all of this new equipment. And now you're saying just, you know, let it sit there because we need to move to the cloud. So there's that component of it as well. And there's in working with a lot of smaller customers, especially, you know, the we call them mom and pop manufacturing. They're not really two or three people, but, you know, that 100, 200 people environment where they've kind of brought the company up on their own, being able to go, you know, walk down the hall and say, hey, there's my data. Right, there's that comfort in saying, you know, so even if there's no compliance issue, what I've seen, especially from that smaller niche, is that, you know, I want to be able to wrap my arms around it and say, yeah, it's mine. So there's still a little bit, I think, of transition in that mentality to the cloud. Yeah. And what is my data, you know, where is my data going to be? What happens if the cloud goes away? So I think as the education, you know, continues with what cloud really is, how you can get your data kept local if you need it and those kind of things, I think some of that on-premise is going to go away. But I think there's always going to be a need for it. And I think you're right. I think it was kind of pushed in from all of the people, you know, saying, hey, we've got compliance issues. We're not going to move forward.
Right.
And, you know, and so that's what we've really seen is a lot of customers saying, well, we're going to wait until it's really baked out and we figure it out. Because even those customers that are thinking about going to the cloud, you know, there's some horror stories of early adopters that didn't really do it right. And they didn't want to have their partner involved in those kind of things. And they say, well, you know, we got through all of this and now nothing works. So I think there's going to be more of that and that understanding that having somebody, you know, that's been there, done that. And yeah, we've implemented this a couple of times. We know the gotchas. Let's help you through it. I think that's really going to help that perception, whether they go cloud or on-prem.
Mm. Yeah. And so there's a separation there between like legal matters and compliance, but then you have that psychology thing that, yeah, you want to wrap your arms around some physical thing and say, these are my service. What about you, Brandon?
Yeah, that's been the couple of issues. And, you know, like Scott said, first, data centers, you know, for example, I have a customer right now that went out and got the most expensive hardware possible. I'm talking about SQL with 196 processors and, you know, 2 terabytes of RAM and nano speed disk drives, right? We compared the speed of Azure's fastest speed to theirs, and their speed was 2,000 times faster. So going to, you know, taking that kind of cutback in hardware, and I realize that's a rare situation, but some of these clients pack a little bit of hardware on them. And, you know, right now, you know, let's look at Azure. We're talking about what were they guaranteeing? 20,000 IHOPs is the fastest, you know, or whatever else, or on average. And we're talking about, you know, some of this in some clients' cases that on these big, big ones, we've got an average of 200,000 IHOPs, which is kind of like what we had. Those kinds of cases are hitting. And then the other thing too is that, you know, and this kind of goes along with what Scott or even with some of the partners, a lot of places are used to having experts that they've brought in themselves, either through whatever else, who can solve issues. Like, for example, if there's a lock, having to call Premier Support, wait on the phone for an emergency issue, do all this sorts of stuff, you know, for a lock. A lot of clients don't like that, you know, for something that takes 5 minutes to disable the, you know, kill the lock or something. Or the most recent lockdowns in SQL, like now in the cloud, they've locked down SQL even on the development VMs recently. So, I mean, you know, I could see production, we all got that, but it's very unpopular at the moment for people who just wanted to be able to use, you know, be able to do some basic exploratory stuff in their development VMs. With SQL being locked down.
Is that something that kind of the users are maybe a bit spoiled because we've had so much power over the application and direct access to like the source code at the core level and also at the databases? Now moving to a cloud world, if you look at other applications that you do in the cloud, you're not able to go in and just do updates to data. You have to kind of go behind it. And there's a stability issue with it, and there's also like an uptime and messing with SQL if you don't know what you're doing from experience,
right?
I've told a lot of my customers that the best thing about AX is that you can do whatever you want, and the worst thing about AX is that you can do whatever you want, right? So it's a lot of that, like you said, you know, people get in and they think, oh yeah, I'm just going to add this, you know, 2 indexes onto the transaction table, and they go, hey, how come AX is running so slow? And there's a perception then that AX is slow, right, as a product. And so I think what Microsoft is trying to do is say, you know, it's not really the product. So if it's done correctly, it's implemented correctly, and we, you know, we take the time and we understand what this is doing, then it's really going to work the way that you want it to. And so I think it's kind of that market perception that they're trying to ensure, right, by locking it down and making it so that they're not leaving it into, you know, in the hands of somebody who says, well, yeah, I installed Word, I know how to run AX, right? So I think that's a lot of why they're doing it this way.
Yeah, there's definitely a culture shift. Consultants won't be able to bring up the AOT and do modifications to the application in live. I think it's still important to constantly push on all the features and tooling that we need in order to help ourselves on technical issues. Like Brandon says, locking situations can happen, and we should not be forced to open support tickets for them. But then again, Microsoft's task will be to design the system not to create locks as well. But we can still create customization that locks. So there is this sort of balance that needs to balance out over time, I guess. But there's also the optimizations of the database and the indexes. That's also a different story on Azure, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But they have added some tooling, as far as I know. They're adding some additional toolings on LCS for monitoring and looking into your system. But that's obviously the cloud version and not the on-prem. On-prem, you will have all sorts of options and possibilities to fix it right there, then and there.
when you do these installations, the customer, what type of customers are you working with to have them on-prem as opposed to just the mom and pop stores? Is that kind of, I would expect no mom and pop store or small manufacturing company have access to that supercomputer that you were talking about, Brandon.
No, so, it's big ones and mainly the $1 billion ones. But part of the reason why we had on-prem was because, you know, let's face it, when it comes to licensing costs, those were the ones who held the significant licensing costs too. And they're almost in general, almost amongst the big ones that I've dealt with, almost every one of them has been very devout. Many of them have rolled out cloud trials, at least minor cloud trials, and they haven't liked it. And the reason is not security with them, the big ones. Now the small ones, I see that. And the exception of government ones too. So I'm not talking about those. Those are very much security. But it's had more to do with kind of what Tommy just alluded to and what you did too. A lot of times they have custom monitoring solutions in that are far more advanced than the current telemetry and lifecycle services. I mean, all the time. In fact, you know, when I first looked at lifecycle services personally, just as a consultant, on a scale of 1 to 10 compared to what I used, I rated it a 1, and that was being generous because it was the lowest. I mean, it did not compare to the sort of things I could see, caching locks, string locks, things running up, you know, being able to run a debug dialogue. I mean, all the kinds of things you do when a client's in trouble, you know, I mean, it just could not do. And yeah, it showed a couple of things like here's a lock over here, whatever else, but what about a lock in the OS, or what about a kernel? What about a kernel bug, or, you know, all the kinds of stuff you deal with on these big ones? None of that I could see. And then, you know, you would call someone from Premier Support like they would. This is what the clients would be telling me. And, you know, you get someone from Premier Support who's basically following a standard, you know, book by book, step by step sort of troubleshooting thing, right? And in that case, they had people in many cases that were internally experts who have been used to dealing with it. And, you know, then you get the overhead. So that's been the biggest reason for me. And I think that as the cloud comes up with more advanced and more sophisticated troubleshooting techniques, and especially gives a little bit more control right now, they've had to lock it down so much because of security and because the tools are not, they're having to support a lot of the security, in my opinion, with business practices, because the tools are not complicated enough to be able to do it. I think that'll win over those types of implementations who are very concerned about service, level of service, and, you know, the fact that with them, downtime is not just something being up. It's actually an application functioning fast. When things begin to go slow, like for example, like on this one, with all their plants and all the and the major manufacturing, let picking slow down, or let something like that slow down by such and such and start crawling. Yeah, that's not classified as downtime for the cloud, but for them, suddenly they're getting behind, potentially losing millions of dollars on contracts. And that's where someone needs to get in quickly and not submit a ticket to Premier Support, wait 4 to 8 hours, right, and whatever else. It needs to be solved just like that. And so for them, I can still see why they wanted the on-prem, but at the same time, I'm not saying that there aren't plenty of implementations who are more well-suited towards the cloud, and that it seems to be a very special subset of very big implementations. And just the fact, with at least what I'm seeing, on-prem not being caught up quite yet to what, you know, what you're able to do if you were advanced enough, and if you could afford to bring someone in advanced enough to be able to do that. And like, for example, we have Scott over here. I've actually worked with Scott. He's well known. I don't know if Scott remembers or not. It's been a few years.
No, I remember.
You do?
I do.
Uh-huh. Well, Scott's extremely advanced at performance tuning. If I had to give Scott a rating versus the lifecycle tools on a scale of 1 to 10, trust me, the lifecycle tools are not going to compare to putting Scott on somebody's implementation. And neither is just calling someone from Premier Support. I'm going to tell you that too. I mean, this is someone who's developed a skill who can solve it when a client's in an emergency, and I've seen him do this, can pull a client out of an emergency quite quickly when there is that locking situation and say, okay, you got locks over here. Yeah, I killed the lock, but I didn't just kill the lock. I also said you need to do this, 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 and this, and this to be able to prevent the lock in the future, right? So let's get you partially stabilized over here and then keep it moving. That's what those clients are used to, though. They pay the money for those kinds of experts, and they got the money for that. Whereas the smaller shop that might be, you know, a smaller one that might not even have an IT staff, they're loving it because they can't afford that kind of expert, and Premier Support is way more than what they've got. So it's, you know, and I'm not knocking Premier Support. I'm just saying there is a difference between, you know, you get it, between one of you guys and between someone who's got their first year at the call center.
Right.
I'm not knocking it, but you get it.
Yeah, it is true. I mean, we are as an AX partner, we have premium support, so we get a quick response from Microsoft within more often less than an hour. But so the customer is then relying on having us as a partner, and we need to call Microsoft or get in touch with them. And but for AX 2012 and previous versions, you're right. We go in and we fix the problem right there and then. So yeah, all of that makes perfect sense, and it's a very good argument for the on-prem. And also the previous heavily investment in hardware. That was one of the main points from Microsoft, at least, to why anyone would go on-prem, is that they already have spent a lot of money on hardware. But I don't think they emphasize so much on what you're talking about, that you can actually go in and solve a real problem for a customer. But I want to hear more stories about that. Scott, he just told us that you are an expert. So do you have any good stories on you want to share with us?
I have lots and lots of stories. Yes, I do. But yeah, I mean, what Brandon is talking about is, you know, I mean, that's kind of a specialty of mine. I mean, I'm a developer and I've done, you know, all of the stuff that's involved in that. But lately it's really been performance tuning and getting in and helping customers understand, you know, that it's not just let's throw more hardware at it. It's really going in and figuring out what is causing this. And there's a lot of perception in the industry. There's a lot of tools that Microsoft provides, like DynPerf and that will go out and say, here's a long running query, here's some index hints, you know, go and create these indexes. And what companies don't really understand is that just going and creating an index is not necessarily just going to make things faster, right? Because there's overhead. And so really trying to educate them on that and understand, here's the impact of what you're trying to do. Here's what we really need to look at, right? You may have another index that's already there. We just need to tweak the query a little bit and make it run faster. You know, so there's a lot of that in addition to going in and looking at SQL and talking about, you know, so you don't have 192 processors, you only got 6. How do we make that run better? You know, and those kind of things, and helping people understand that level of performance. And it's really, you know, a lot of it, what I think a lot of the technical people that go in and look at this, and Brandon can probably talk to this as being partially functional as well, is, and I don't mean that in a bad way, right? I always tell people that I like to be called technical as opposed to non-functional, because the functional consultants go in. Anyways, so what, you know, in bridging that gap between the hardware and the process is really important, because a lot of people, especially when they implement a new system, you know, they think about how they did it in the old system, and it may not be the right process, and they may just be doing things in the wrong order, or you know, they're not used to doing it in the new way, and that's actually causing a lot of the problems. I had one customer recently that I went in and I was talking to, and you know, they were doing a lot of things interactively because they were told at some point, you know, we don't want to use the batch server. And I wasn't involved before that, so I'm not sure why. But, you know, I went in and sat down and said, well, how come we're not doing this batch? And that was their answer, because they told us not to, right? And so I said, okay, well, let's just try that, right? Let's just try that. And so they went from having a terminal that was locked for 2 hours because they were running it interactively, to be able to go and actually do a bunch of stuff that they would normally, you know, be waiting on the system for. And at the end of the first day that I was there was a woman that said, I get to go home on time today. and I said, what do you mean today? How long has it been? And she said, it's been weeks. It's been, you know, you could probably measure it in months, where she's been doing this process. And it, because they were running it interactively on the client, it ran so much slower than on the batch server, that just changing that process got them through. So it's not always just the technical component that you need to be aware of. It's that who's clicking the button and how were they told how to click it.
Yeah.
That is a good story. But so on the topic of performance and scaling, I just browsed through the documentation on online for installing the on-prem. Let's just say that the scroll bar was like this.
right.
But I saw that they had some numbers on how much transactions, how many users, and they even distinguished between type of license users you want to have per CPU. And what is the bare minimum on-prem installation you would do? Because it seemed to me like that wouldn't basically support a lot of work if you just had one single, yeah. Do you have any measurements or ideas or thoughts about that?
Yeah. The biggest thing customers have pointed out to me that they didn't like is in our particular design, we have three orchestrator servers that in plenty of other applications, they're used jointly to actually do something. In ours, they mainly send telemetry data back to LCS.
Mm.
They do a little bit of management, but you name it. And what you could do with the three orchestrators is you could, and plenty of people do, you could place other things on them to make them work like an application or whatever else. We don't have that for our sandboxes. So what's happening is, you're right, beyond the 13 servers or the 10 servers that you set up, and I'm going like production, let's say 13 servers, you're still, suddenly you're hit with one or two AOSs, which you can think of, you know, we go to these big environments, we're seeing 30 AOSs and 40 AOSs.
Mm.
And so you start to run into a severe bottleneck. And then what's also not been documented so far, that's the on-premise story. And this could also be an advantage over some of the cloud, is a lot of times, you know, you've got replicas and you've got special configurations, timeouts, whatever else. None of that's covered, but that's a huge topic for being able to tune performance. It has big, big effects. Limit the number of replicas, for example. Turn around and set the timeouts for being able to find certain types of services. Are you going to error here or not error here? All of that's in there, and there's practically no guidance whatsoever. So that was a bit of a learning curve for me to have to go through that one and start to figure out just how big of a difference it is. And I'll give you guys an example. I ran it on 16 gigs in four processors, and I maxed out at 100% just after a while on just an AOS. I then turned around and I limited the replicas, right, by putting in a rule. And now it never hits more than 20% of the resources, and it's faster. Mm. So huge, huge thing around configuring Service Fabric that I didn't even know of when I first started. And now it's just, you know, like, okay, wow. And there's pretty much nothing on there for being able to configure it for the AOS, but it has a huge effect on the number of users.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a sort of like a bad, horrible question, but you provided that feedback back to Microsoft, right? So they put that in their recommendations.
Microsoft Research and I have had, because, you know, they always bring research to the big implementations, as we know.
Okay.
We've had conversations that I can't disclose online.
That's fine.
You understand?
Yeah, sure. But they are on this, and because I assume that would probably be one thing that you want to have documented for your next implementation, if there was a next one, and you want to have all of those things part of the installation documentation, making that document even bigger. Mm.
It would be nice.
Yeah.
I'm sure you guys understand too. There are certain things we have our little disclosures on.
Yeah.
But trust me, these conversations have happened.
Yeah. Do you have any experience on the performance side, Scott?
Well, I was just going to say, I think that it kind of gets lost in the documentation that's out there and how to install it and everything. But when you think about what the Service Fabric does, it's really a mini hypervisor. Right, it's almost like a toned down Hyper-V, where because you're exposing resources and it's creating effectively containers that are the AOS and the SQL Server, and, you know, and it's publishing a lot of that. And I think what people are going to notice is the kind of thing that Brandon's talking about. When you think back to where VMware first started, right, and a lot of the issues that people had, iMotion was there. Hey, let's turn that on. Let's make sure that, you know, any host that has a bottleneck can move to, or VM that has a bottleneck can move to another host. And then people are live migrating their SQL Server at the busiest time of the day, and performance all of a sudden just tanks, right? So there's a lot of things, I think, that when we start looking at the Service Fabric and how we can maintain it and turning on automatic updates and those kind of things, that, you know, you follow along in the guidelines and you go, well, okay, so I just shot myself in the foot, because now I did something that you know, it wasn't really documented, but it's the way that the Service Fabric is designed to work to make it, you know, so that your job is easier. But because we're kind of using it, I mean, the Service Fabric started as kind of a microservice type environment where you could deploy things and that. And so we're taking it kind of out of its comfort zone. And I think a lot of that, there's going to be a lot of learning curves in that. And you know, some of the customers that I've spoken to that are looking at doing this, even though they have IT departments, they look through that documentation, they go, yeah, you know what, we want you guys to be responsible for that, because if it breaks, I don't want to lose my job.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So production, 13 VMs, basically 13 nodes. Yeah, that's the minimum. And if you want to have like a test, test or dev, you basically just download a VHD single box thing. Or well, do you do anything else?
This is where people have been a little bit upset. So what's happened is, like we know now, the single box dev VM, like I can use it to do upgrades, hot fixes. We know though it's not sufficient because, you know, like I said, you have to connect it to another tenant, and on premise that's not supported. Whereas in the cloud, it's instant. And that's a big consideration that I've been telling implementations. A lot of times people don't realize how much extra configuration is required to get that local one box dev to actually connect to a tenant and change all those IIS settings and whatever else. And they keep changing the application with platform updates so it doesn't work in just a little bit. And right now I don't have that scripted out. It's manual, not even documented, completely off the grid type thing. You have to have a sandbox install, which is supposed to require a minimum of 7 different servers.
Mm. And what do you do when there's a release of a new application? You have to reinstall it or can you patch it? What do you do?
Well, this is extremely interesting, and this is one of the big drawbacks that we've got. There's, I don't know what you guys are seeing on this platform updates story. I'm getting a lot of pushback from customers that are pretty angry at the moment. I guess in the cloud, it may not be as big of a deal because customers can just unprovision, reprovision, and as long as they have something in source control, they can get away with it. But when it comes to unprovisioning 13 different servers, and right now the install is not really scripted out. Parts of it are scripted out, but it's a very manual install. I mean, like, for example, it took me going back and forth with the domain admin 2 weeks. I mean, 2 weeks to do this. And this was not a production install. We're talking about an environment where I was used to going in AX2012 and, you know, you need to just set up. Someone got the environment. Okay, give me 4 or 5 hours, right? And that's why you're walking away, getting eating breaks and whatever. And this was 2 straight weeks. So now suddenly whenever these new platform updates come out that make it very incompatible. And in fact, we just had that. We just had a breaking change. I've talked to Microsoft Research about it, but the newest version of Service Fabric broke the new on-premise version. And the link on the webpage basically says to download, you know, this brand new version of Service Fabric, when in fact you look inside the application and it's got a version of Service Fabric that's older, so it starts skipping files during the install and doing all kinds of bad stuff.
Mm.
Well, how would that work if you use 2 weeks to do that? So then it's 3 weeks to the next platform update. So you kind of get pretty much a full-time employee, right?
Yeah, they've had 4 of them since then. Yeah.
Yeah. So you skip a couple until the next one?
It's a big issue. You know, it is. I mean,
yeah,
it is right now. I mean, it's a bad one. And there's not a solution that I see just yet for it at all in terms of the on-prem solution.
Yeah, but you would do a platform update for supporting basically new standard features, but not necessarily ISV solutions and customizations like that. But like I saw the platform update 11 had features around copying a company, for example. But so I've stalled PU10. I had issues with PU10, so I stalled that one. But I think PU11 seems a little bit more stable. But I see what you're getting at. So that's you have similar experience, Scott, with your installs.
Yeah, we've had a lot of conversations with customers about that. Have tried to, you know, because they're used to the, well, let's stand up this VM, right? And then we patch it so that it's current.
Right.
And that whole idea of just check things into TFS or VSTS, you know, throw away the VM, just download a new one and then sync it. And, you know, that's kind of a foreign concept of this throwaway VM kind of thing. It's moving more towards that container, right? When you think about containers and Docker and those kind of things, that's really where the development world is going. And so I think that's Microsoft's philosophy is, you know, there's nothing really intrinsic to this box that you need. All your source code and everything is checked in. Just wipe it out and go because it's going to be faster. But I think the implementation of that has a lot of work to go. Because, I mean, even if you're trying to download the new VM, right, you go to the site and, okay, now let's download, you know, disk file 1. Now click on disk file 2.
Right.
Okay, so there's a downloader that you can use that will download it all, and it works on half of the machines that I've installed it on. So you still end up clicking on these things. So I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in order to streamline that process. Mm. And if we can get it into more, and I know that they're working towards this, getting it more to where it's in an Azure environment and you can just go and click an image and deploy it, right? And then we start using MSDN credits and those kind of things to kind of offset the cost. I think that's kind of where we're going to need to go, at least in the short term, so that we're not spending 2 weeks of our development cycle getting a development machine ready. Well, I mean, the idea behind a container, so if you're trying to take a container and move it to a different location and you're going across the internet or a different network, you're going to have that same issue, right? Because it's a file size that you have to transfer. So the idea behind the container is that I can set it up once and then people can just kind of clone it rapidly in the same infrastructure. If I'm trying to clone it, you know, from Azure down onto my on-prem, I'm still going to have that internet delay. So it's not necessarily something that they could do that way. And it goes along with how they're doing it now. So if I took a VM and just downloaded it, right, a container is really just an isolated VM. It still has an OS and those kind of things. So it's generally smaller, and I don't have to worry about, once I've got it downloaded, now connecting it to my domain because I've got an image where it's already connected. So it's kind of that all of that pre-work is in place, and it's just easier to clone. And with the way that Microsoft is kind of setting this up and all of the different domains and all of the different ways that users want to use this, they can't really get to that containerized final vision, right? So I think, and that's why I think Azure is going to kind of be that best location for it, is because a lot of the time that we're spending now in getting these new versions is the lag to get it down to my local environment. So if I can just go in and say clone, right, and they've already kind of containerized it now in Azure, and I just say, here's my disk image, just go spin up an image of this, you know, an hour, 2 hours later, I've got the new VM. And in that way, it's feasible now to just connect it to VSTS, do a sync, and get it up and running, right? Where if I'm doing a platform upgrade, generally, as long as it's supported, because in a lot of the dev instances that you're downloading, they say they don't support an upgrade. So as long as you could get it supported, it would generally be faster to do an upgrade because it's a lot smaller amount of data that needs to come down across the internet.
Mm. Well, when you're talking about connecting VSTS, then you're talking about getting your source code for a developer.
Correct.
Yeah. But for a binary update, if you just want to install the latest version of your application with its customizations and ISV solutions, the story is sort of similar, right? You reinstall, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's okay, because when you connect to the database and you probably run some post upgrades process, then it still works. There's definitely no ID conflicts like it used to be.
Right.
I've heard people say when they're thinking about ERP on-prem, they're thinking about NAV instead of AX, sort of automatically. But it's interesting, like Scott said, they've changed dependencies and requirements for the on-prem story from how it was in the beginning, and also like Brian alluded to. So Microsoft is definitely on a journey here going towards something, and that something has to be an easier way to implement the on-prem, and also give us the proper tooling and to make it easier for us and the proper documentation. But it sounds like it's still a way to go to get there. But
so you were 50-50 at the moment?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But don't be wrong, though. I mean, also, too, though, you know, and this is just listening, I haven't, you know, as an independent and don't work for Microsoft, I can't go into a client and just give the Microsoft viewpoint 100%. Not in my line of work, not whatever else, you know. And there's some clients where I can say, yeah, the cloud's great. But there are other clients where, like I said, like this one, why would they reduce their performance 2,000 times when they pay for this hardware to go to the cloud? You know, yeah. But that's not everybody. So, yeah, I guess it just depends on the client is what I'd say, you know. Microsoft has told them to go cloud.
Yeah. If they're willing to spend so much money on hardware, they're willing to spend time and money on letting you spend time on installing it on their hardware, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are a significant number of them like that, or a small number, but they're big enough to where you get the point. They make up a significant number of market share.
Mm. And they are pushing Microsoft also to support that in a better way, I suppose.
I'm optimistic. I think it's like Scott said, you know, we're in the beginning where Microsoft really is trying to apply AX as a microservice, you know, with the containers. I mean, you take a pure container, right? And the thing about a pure container is that a pure container doesn't even have an OS. It just runs an application that's independent, like, you know, SharePoint, Sandbox, that kind of thing. And right now in our version of container, we have to have an OS for every single, you know, part of the installation, AOS, this, and this. And that eats up a lot of resources, but you can see them getting there though, you know, and you can see improvements that are coming both for the cloud and the whatever else. And they're not there yet, but like I said, this is the first version of a microservice. I mean, the most successful microservice that we've seen so far is Amazon.com that works like that, where you've got these very, very well-defined services that are able to scale out across really pretty much, I won't say independent of an operating system, but multiple ones on an operating system to manage performance and whatever. And I think they're trying to get there with AX, and I think they needed to make this move. I think a lot of clients need to make this move to D365. If not the cloud, then I do think on-prem, because I mean, let's face it, RESTful services, microservices, that's where it's at to be able to get all the new functionality. You can't hang around on the other one or otherwise lose competitive advantage. So kind of our industry at the moment where companies need to stay ahead or risk becoming like some of the other bad cases we've seen that Amazon put out of business.
Yeah, it's changing so fast, and like you said, Tommy, you know, when you think about what Microsoft's roadmap is for this, you can really see them trying to move away from that monolithic type environment, right? When you look at D365 as it is right now, all of the functionality that comes with that, there's a lot of customers that don't necessarily need that, and so you can see that in the rest of the D365 ecosphere kind of thing, where you've got Talent and you've got Field Service, and they're kind of breaking up these, you know, into pieces, the functionality that you would normally consider as an ERP. And I think where we're going to get to, and it's definitely going to be a transition, right? There's so many things that change on a daily basis in the cloud and with technology as it's evolving, and people say, hey, you know, that was a great idea, but I think now we need to do this. And you've got, you know, 700 million lines of code that you need to go, okay, now let's go do this, right? That there's time that takes. And I think people are getting used to, well, you know, there was an update yesterday. And Microsoft's trying to move that way, right? And make it so that it's more kind of isolated and you can keep pace with the functionality because now it's broken apart. And so I can make a change to this one and not worry about what it's going to do to this one. So there's that evolution that's happening, not just in the industry, but Microsoft is, you know, they said, we're going to be a cloud company, right? And so that whole, let's move into the cloud, let's take advantage of all of this, and they're developing that way. And then somebody comes along and says, well, no, I need to run this on-premise. Well, we've designed it from the ground up in order to take advantage of all of these cloud services that just aren't available in a micro-scale data center, right? And so now they've got to retool it. You know, so instead of rewriting all of that code, now they try and put something in place that says, well, let's act as an intermediary, right? And so I think that's kind of where they're at right now, is that they've moved forward so much with this cloud first that trying to get things not really retrofitted, but to work in that smaller environment is a lot of the issues that we're kind of encountering. And I think they're going to mature in that, right? They're going to get used to that, and they're going to understand the technology a little bit better, and their dev teams are going to start working towards, we're going to do cloud first, but we need to keep this kind of in our back pocket, right? And they understand that when they're developing it, maybe we need to create this tool at the same time that's going to make it so that it will run on premise, and we're going to see it kind of functioning a little bit better as they go. But you know, where they're going, where Microsoft going, is brand new technology.
Thank you so much to Scott and Brandon for joining us on this Dynamics podcast. Tommy, you can find him at Skiva on Twitter and also yetanotherax.com. That's where he blogs everything. Go and check out Brandon at InstructorBrandon on Twitter and go to instructorbrandon.com to find his blog and also the course that's coming up. So stay tuned on his blog. Go and subscribe. You can find Scott's things at scottamarley.wordpress.com. That's where he writes his blog. And you can also follow him at Scott A. Marley. That's Scott A. Marley. Go check out the information. We have some links that you can clickety-clack down in the description if you want to go check out their stuff. And also, go and check out their sessions that's coming up. But Brandon's got his tomorrow. I'm not sure if I can publish this before that, but go check out the recording on dynamicscommunities.com. You can find Brandon's recording there, and you can also sign up for, in November sometime, Scott's session on his experience on local business data will be broadcasted. So go to Dynamic Communities and subscribe and get that information. For more information on Dynamics Podcast, go to dynpodcast.com. That's dynpodcast.com. Go to our YouTube channel for all the latest information. Also, subscribe to get information on when we do our live sessions. So go check that out and subscribe. Also, you can find us on Twitter and also on Facebook. Of course, we are a podcast, so we will be available where you subscribe to podcasts as well. You can go to iTunes or any type of podcasting app and find us there. Please tell us if you aren't able to find us on the podcasting app that you use. We'll make sure that it pops up there as well. So thank you so much for watching. Click and subscribe and like this video, and we'll see you next time. Bye. We'll be right back.